And speaking of Smartify, right now it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup.
Noah Ovshinsky joins us. The latest state political poll lets us know how voters are feeling about presidential candidates and Governor Walker.
Wisconsin has joined five other states in a lawsuit aimed at the Affordable Care Act.
And state lawmakers have started appointing officials to the new Ethics and Elections Boards.
And we'll cover all those stories right now with WPR's news director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Veronica.
We're going to start out today looking at the Marquette University, the latest poll from Marquette University. What did we find out?
So as one would expect, given the season that we're in, it looked at the presidential race. The headline here is, you know, that no single candidate looks to be really pulling away at the moment, at least in a convincing manner. It showed Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton basically tied on the Democratic side.
And what about the Republican side?
The poll has Donald Trump leading the pack with 30% of the vote here in Wisconsin, followed by Marco Rubio at 20% and Ted Cruz at 19%. Ben Carson and John Kasich both came in at 8% in this poll.
And so with that 30% for Trump, looks like he's got the lion's share of support. Is it as simple as that?
Right now, it looks like he certainly has most of the support. However, if you dig into the numbers a little deeper, they reveal a real split among the Republican electorate here in Wisconsin. 45% view him positively, according to this latest poll, and 45% view him negatively. And, you know, one of the big unknowns at this point is, you know, how many challengers will Trump have when the Wisconsin primary comes along? You know, right now, GOP voters are, you know, spreading their support among several candidates. If the field shrinks, you know, that could alter the dynamic we're going to see play out, you know, certainly across the country and potentially here in Wisconsin when the primary comes along.
So we've got Super Tuesday coming up, and this could be one of those winnowing factors that you're talking about for the GOP field. But barring all the unknowns, does it look like Wisconsin could still matter in the primary scene?
I think the potential is there, absolutely. You know, after March 15th, that's when Illinois, Florida, and Ohio goes to the polls. You know, the candidates will be spending a lot of time here in Wisconsin. Of course, that's assuming that, you know, we still have a lot of people in the race. You know, they're going to be spending a lot of time in Wisconsin. You know, for Sanders and Clinton, you know, Wisconsin would be a real prize. Especially for Sanders. You know, he enjoys a lot of support here, and a win, I think, would add some much-needed fire to his campaign. You know, for Clinton, it's another opportunity to add to her, you know, delegate count, which is growing.
And the Wisconsin primary, it's early April, right?
Yeah, the primary here in Wisconsin is April 5th.
So switching gears from the presidential race to just the state of Wisconsin, this poll also took a look at Governor Walker's latest approval rating. What do we see there?
Right. So the headline here is his approval rating hasn't actually budged all that much since the last poll. And in fact, hasn't moved a lot since late summer. His approval rating now stands at 39%.
And looking back a year ago, has there been movement there?
Definitely a lot of movement. His approval rating actually started to dip when he began his presidential campaign. A year ago, his approval rating hovered around 48%. Since then, of course, it's dropped around 10 percentage points. So it's certainly down if you look at what's happened in the last year.
And the poll also took a look at the Supreme Court race here in Wisconsin, too. What did we see there?
Right. And so, you know, in addition to the presidential race, this will be the other race that voters will be looking at come April. And, you know, this, too, just like the Democratic side for the presidential race, this one is looking like a real squeaker, at least at this point. State Appeals Judge Joanne Kloppenburg and incumbent Justice Rebecca Bradley are essentially in a dead heat. Among likely voters, Kloppenburg had 36% of support. Bradley had 37%. You know, that's well within the margin of error. So it's a tight race.
And what do we know about undecided voters in this big picture?
Right. So according to the poll, there were as many as, you know, 23%. And again, you know, if you dig deeper, what the poll reveals is that, you know, there's a lot of people in the state who don't know enough about either of those two candidates to actually have an opinion.
It's still early on, but is that common for voters not to be super well informed about who the candidates are?
For this kind of race, for this kind of Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, it's not all that surprising. You know, neither enjoys a high level of name recognition. Justice Bradley hasn't been on the Supreme Court bench for very long. And also the Supreme Court race is officially nonpartisan here in Wisconsin. So, you know, voters would have to dig a little deeper to figure out which candidate is aligned with their own beliefs. So, you know, those two things put together means that, you know, in the minds of most voters in Wisconsin, at least at this point, they don't know a lot about these two candidates. And so both of those candidates presumably will be spending the next several weeks trying to make sure that voters do know who they are.
We're talking right now with WPR's news director, Noah Oshchinsky, talking about the biggest headlines from around the state this week.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our Wisconsin News Roundup now with Noah Oshchinsky. And Noah, what can you tell us about the appointees to the state's new elections and ethics boards?
Right. So this is some of the biggest news we've seen since the legislature and the governor decided to dissolve the Government Accountability Board late last year. And so what's happened just this past week is that the governor and party leaders have started appointing members to the state's newly created elections and ethics commissions. Those are what going to replace the GAB. And the GAB, just as a reminder, was basically made up of retired judges. This new system, these two new commissions, will be governed by partisan appointees. And what we've seen this week is the appointment of the first two appointees with these commissions.
Okay, well, let's look at that. Who were the first two appointees?
So Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald nominated Katie McCallum to the Ethics Commission. She is the Secretary of the Republican Party. And Senate Democratic Leader Jennifer Schilling appointed Ann Jacobs to the Elections Commission. And she is a personal injury lawyer from Milwaukee and an expert on election law.
Noah, do you have any sense about how these two appointees are being received?
It's early yet. It's early yet. And the GAB is, you know, still officially in charge of elections. They'll be in charge of the election coming up in April. These new commissions begin operations on June 30th. So it'll be very interesting to see between now and then who else gets appointed to these really important boards.
And we're going to wrap up with a look at Wisconsin taking part in a lawsuit over the Affordable Care Act. Set this up for us, Noah. What happened?
Right. So this is one of, you know, really several lawsuits that the state of Wisconsin has jumped into, sometimes with other states, against the Obama administration. You know, sometimes they have to do with pollution rules. This has to do with the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, is very unpopular amongst the governor and his GOP colleagues in the state. Wisconsin joined six other states in this particular lawsuit, and essentially what they're doing is they're suing to recover money that the state has had to pay out to cover these fees that were created by the Affordable Care Act. And in this case, it's what's called the Health Insurance Provider's Fee, which, as the name implies, insurance companies were supposed to pay under the Affordable Care Act in order to raise money. And in most cases, they do pay this fee, or if they are a nonprofit or work with people who come from low-income families, they are exempt from paying this fee or pay far less because they're nonprofits versus their for-profit brothers and sisters. And so this is kind of where it gets a little complicated, but I'm going to try to break it down. So we were talking about nonprofits. They don't have to pay this fee, or they pay far less of this fee. Well, here in Wisconsin, the state relies on for-profit companies to manage Medicaid. And so what's happened is the state of Wisconsin, because it relies on these for-profit companies, has had to pick up the tab for some of these fees. And Wisconsin, as I said, is just one of seven states that are in this situation, and they're trying to recover some of this money that they've had to pay out under the Affordable Care Act.
And so how much money are we talking about here?
So in 2014 and 2015, according to this lawsuit, Wisconsin spent more than $23 million paying these fees under the Affordable Care Act.
So going forward, what is the next piece of action expected to be on this? Do we know?
So it's at this point, it's up to the courts to see which direction they will go. And, you know, at this point, it's hard to say, you know, where the courts will actually land on it.
Noah, thanks a lot.
It was good to be back. Thanks, Veronica.
That was WPR News Director Noah Oshinsky bringing us up to speed on the biggest stories from around the state this week.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 1% of the world population has an autism spectrum disorder. In addition, the diagnosis of autism in American children increased by nearly 120% from the years 2000 to 2010. And that means more and more families are becoming familiar with a disorder that was relatively unknown just a few decades ago.
Our next guest is a national expert on autism and now calls Wisconsin home. He gave a presentation earlier today at UW Green Bay called The New Look at the Needs of Teens and Adults on the Autism Spectrum. He joins us now to talk about some of the points he raised and how Wisconsin is doing when it comes to helping people with autism and their families.
Michael John Carley is the founder of GRASP, the largest organization for adults on the autism spectrum. He's now a school consultant based in Green Bay, a public speaker, and the author of Asperger's from the Inside Out and Unemployed on the Autism Spectrum. He joins us from our studios in Green Bay. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Veronica and Rob, thank you both very, very much for having me.
Well, one of the big themes that you talked about today, you spoke about, was how we progress as a society when it comes to how we view behavior differences. How have you seen that come out into play over the last few decades when it comes to how we view people with autism?
I think that there's been an absolutely remarkable just metamorphosis where we've gone from this very behaviorally not so pluralistic society into one that is much more accepting of behavioral differences, where, you know, the average Joe on the street doesn't freak out if somebody flaps their arms. And this really plays a large part into the ability for individuals on the autism spectrum to be able to, let's say, take part in that figurative American dream and have a family and have a career, because if more of us are being, you know, having our behaviors allowed to exist within greater society, then of course we're getting more jobs and having more relationships and, God forbid, procreating more, and therefore, you know, living the lives that we were probably more intended to live than those that were projected on us, you know, 20 years ago.
To take this into your own personal story, I've read that it took you a really long time for you to feel like you belong somewhere. Do you think that today it would be easier for a young kid growing up to get to that sense of belonging earlier in their life?
Yes, I do, so long as they have the proper supports. I mean, in general, I think that there's a golden rule about life where if, no matter who you are, and, you know, whether we're going to talk about neurological makeup or race or gender or sexual orientation or economic background, that if you're raised to feel good about who you are, you will have a shot at that happy life. Whereas in whatever environment or culture you find yourself in, if you're not raised to feel good about who you are, of course you're going to have a much harder time with that. And I think that that's a very universal law.
So you said the supports. What kinds of supports do you think should be there in place for people who are growing up with autism?
Well, right off the bat, I think you need a family atmosphere that is accepting of the fact that you're going to have behavioral differences. And that when, you know, if your particular special interest is trains and you want to spend, you know, 3 hours of your free time on trains and it's not getting in the way of your schoolwork, that so long as you're not, you know, sacrificing your physical condition to that, that you'll be allowed to focus on those trains without family members thinking of it as an obsession and instead seeing of it as a passion. And after that, I would say that, of course, it relates to your schooling. And are you getting the type of education that will really bring out the best in you and allow you to be absorbed into that greater community without any great sacrifices to your self-esteem and your confidence?
And you're a school consultant now. What would you tell educators at the elementary level? And I know college was really huge for you, too. What about what went right for you in those places?
I think that, you know, back then, you know, when I was going to school, I really in my schooling got saved by a real hippie school, which is what we used to call this, the alternative schools back then. And it was interesting because looking back, they were making the same mistakes about my behavioral differences, whereas others were having their mistakes interpreted in an extreme negative. And I was the lucky kid. I was the one who was getting all of their behavioral differences misinterpreted into extreme positives. People thought that I was, I think, much more intelligent than I really am. I promise you, I'm so much dumber than I sound. But that very essence of being thought of as, positively for what made you different. And you get it. You are definitely different than your peers. That allowed me to have the confidence to go, kick whatever doors down you need to in your life to have the experiences that you want and to have the satisfaction of whatever your dreams might be, at least having the chance to take a shot at them.
Now, you haven't lived in Wisconsin your whole life. You're in Green Bay right now. And I know you lived on the East Coast for a long time, New York for a chunk of the time. How do you think the Midwest does? In particular, how does Wisconsin do in giving the kind of supports that you're talking about for people with autism?
I think that you have to divide this, Veronica, into two categories, and one is which in theory and one of which is in practice. The theory, I would say that, after 28 years of New York City and the school consulting I did there, it was more of a traditional special education type of environment where you had a variety of programs, whether it was all autism or all special education or bridge programs or mainstream programs. And the Midwest in general has always really been much more about inclusion programs. And we all kind of know that inclusion programs, obviously, in the right situations and if they're managed well, will not only benefit, the kids, but also save a little bit of money as well. And when I first came out here, I will confess that I was very skeptical about the whole notion of transferring into this inclusion-based environment. But I will say that after spending enough time, I consult mostly in the Milwaukee and Madison areas, even though I live in Green Bay, and that I kind of drank the Kool-Aid a little bit, which surprised me. I can see the universal benefit and that if we really value emotional confidence more so than grades, that, this actually really, really could work. But the problem that I see is in the practical level of it, because when you don't put the money into the inclusion environment, not putting money into a traditional special education environment that's needed isn't going to cause anywhere near the same amount of damage as not putting that same amount of money into an inclusion environment. And I think that with all the drama surrounding, the, absolute seemingly assault on public education that I've seen since arriving in Wisconsin, which just absolutely baffles me, that it's actually turning these inclusion programs into things that really work against the kids because the supports are not there. If that teacher doesn't have that quality aid to take that kid who's really struggling in the classroom and be able to spend some time with them outside the classroom, then two things are going to happen. Number one, the regular teacher is not going to be able to teach the other kids. So they're going to lose out on learning. And secondly, what's going to happen, the parents of those other kids are going to hate that child that needed the attention that distracted the teacher away. And so suddenly you're going to have the demonization of that child's diagnosis. And it's making for a miserable situation for many, many families.
It's interesting to hear you say this because, I guess this is an inclusion environment in Wisconsin. Proponents of that method say that, you're not singling out certain kids as different, that everyone gets the same opportunities, everyone gets a chance to belong, and you have this diverse group of kids, and everyone has a role to play. But you're saying it's a little more complicated.
It's much more complicated. I think that that's a very cowboy culture, kind of thing to say. This whole thing of, we're all one big happy family, but we're not. We're, of course, all very, very different. And many of us have learning styles that, while it may not take us out of the realm of the human condition, is dramatic enough to sometimes require a different teaching style, just as, sometimes we require a different therapeutic style. And I think a real inclusion program that works and that is the model which Wisconsin, as well as the other Midwestern states, is really trying to get is one which can address more than one teaching style required in that classroom. But again, if they're not going to be funded, then it's not going to work. And one teaching style does not work for all kids.
Well, autism in general, if we look at the whole, I guess has not been diagnosed and understood that well, and we're still learning things about it. What do you think are some of the misconceptions that are still out there that you'd like to clear up?
Oh, boy. It changes so often, and I think that it changes so much, with the times. And it also pertains to the culture in which you live. Like, you've rightfully mentioned the fact that I come from New York City, and I'm trying still, after 18 months in Wisconsin, to sort of acclimate myself to some very noble but sometimes very problematic standards of behavior. I think that, coming from where I'm coming from, you see this stereotypical stand-up Midwestern guy iconography, or this stereotypical stand-up Midwestern gal iconography. And, from the outset, there's, really noble stuff about that stuff, because it has to do with being solid. And it's something that I associate, quite frankly, with my wife, whom I love like crazy and who I'm very, very grateful that I married.
When you say stand-up, do you mean kind of stoic?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. One who, is just solid. I guess the word I would use would be more along the lines of solid. Mm-hmm. But because it's one in which is very sort of behaviorally pointed, I think that if you're somebody who's, let's say, the weird guy, or, whatever that stereotype might mean, or somebody that is a little bit outside the realms of the behavioral norm and has all these behaviors which, surprise people, let's say, then that's sometimes going to have a little bit more of a negative effect in the Midwest than it might somewhere else where there isn't the same sort of behavioral standards set up. So there are pros and cons to each situation. And I think that I'm still in the throes of learning from what I think is a very fascinating experience that I'm having here in the state of Wisconsin.
So do you think it's easier to be a person on the autism spectrum on the East Coast than it is in the Midwest?
Oh, did you have to push me like that?
Yep, I did.
The answer is yes, because we allow weird. We're just more acclimated to it. It's more of a behaviorally pluralistic environment. I look around, Green Bay. Do I see a lot of quote unquote behaviorally different people, running the businesses around here? No, I don't. I don't think that that's because, people are mean by any means. You're 20 times nicer here than from where I come from. And there's value to that. But I do think that actually the Midwest is very hard for individuals on the autism spectrum, specifically because of that behavioral difference. And, I think also that, that cowboy culture thing about, that we're all one big happy family. I mean, one of the myths about autism, going back to your original question, of course, here, that I think we've learned, but not everybody has learned fully enough, is that, when one person is diagnosed, it affects a tremendous amount of people within that family dynamic. And I think one of the mistakes that we've made in the past is when the most well-meaning families say to themselves, we will go through this as a family. Now, you can partly do that, but I don't think you can fully do it in the spirit in which that statement comes out. And the reason being that the individual on the spectrum has their own walk to walk, and the parents cannot walk that walk for them. And the parents have their own walk to walk, and the individual cannot walk that walk for them either. Grandparents have their walk to walk. Siblings have their walk to walk. And as a pro-family guy, before I start to look like I want to see families get separated, I would say that the ideal situation that we're all sort of learning is our best recipe for family success is that everybody have the guts to go walk their walk. And many people do not have the guts to go walk their walk. But that if that family contingent all walks their walks and then comes together at the end of the day and has a family meal together and they share how their walks went, that to me is the ideal scenario.
Michael, thanks so much. It's been really great to talk to you.
Veronica, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Michael Giancarli is the founder of GRASP, the largest organization of adults on the autism spectrum. And he's now a school consultant based in Green Bay, a public speaker, and the author of the book, Asperger's from the Inside Out.